You are listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. Join him as he and his guests discover how businesses thrive in California.
Well, welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405. We have a great interview this morning. We're going to be listening and talking with J.D. Sitton, the CEO of CTC Global, and I want you to learn a little bit about what CTC Global is doing from Irvine in the world. So welcome to The Pilgrim.
Thanks, Will. It's great to be here.
So tell us a little bit about what CTC Global does.
CTC Global, the purpose for its existence is to expand access to the power grid in predominantly in developing countries around the world. We manufacture a technology that enables higher capacity power lines to operate much more efficiently for moving power from point A to point B.
Tell me a little bit about that. This is not just putting in lines. That's not your main value add, is it?
Correct. It's not. It's actually developing and manufacturing a core, a strength member for high voltage power lines. That strength member is resistant to thermal energy, so it doesn't sag when the lines get loaded. It's stronger than steel, and that allows the utilities to put up basically twice the amount of aluminum or capacity on the same space. And so within the existing infrastructure, we can increase the capacity of power lines and allow them to operate about 40% more efficiently.
So this has to do with the weight of the lines,
yes,
is that right?
Yes, the weight of the line. Basically, the weight of the line is limited by the strength of the towers. So mm-hmm. as you're driving along down the road and you see these big lattice structures holding up power lines, the capacity of that line is basically defined by the strength carrying capability of those towers.
All right, so let's talk about the global impact. Now, you were mentioning that you're in, what is it, 50 countries?
Mm-hmm.
So when you walk in and talk to the utility in a particular country, is it that they aren't, they don't have an infrastructure right now and that becomes the advantage, or?
In almost every case, they already have a transmission infrastructure, a power transmission infrastructure. And what they need is more capacity to move power from new generators to the existing markets. And so they need a solution that allows them to reuse the towers, reuse the rights of way, because utilities around the world face a common constraint, and that is very few of them are going to get more new right of ways. They've got to do much more with the right of ways they have, and we enable that to happen.
So it's the right of ways as well as the tower infrastructure.
Absolutely.
And so what would it be safe to say that what you're really doing is then allowing them to put more power through their existing infrastructure?
Yes, exactly.
Wow, and that must be a tremendous ROI for
It's a huge utility. Thing. One of the largest markets that we've had over the last 3 years or so is in Bangladesh. Their national utility company is called PGCB. And one of the issues that they've faced perpetually over probably the last 25 years is they've routinely outgrown their utility plans, which means they end up having to constrain power to farmers at the peak of the growing season. That means the farmers cannot water their crops, and they're stunted, and so the production yields are much, much lower than they could be. And so they've adopted our technology and done a major grid reconfiguration using our product, and that's allowed them to dramatically reduce the incident rate of power blackouts and brownouts. And so the farmers are doing a much better job raising crops. That gives them more money. They can do a better job leaving their kids in school, raises education rates, and helps enable overall economic growth.
That's amazing. You know, what I really like about what you're saying is it's not often that I hear people talking about their social impact, even though there are major social impacts in almost every business. But it's very rare that I hear people actually talking about that before they talk about their own EBITDA.
Well, it's fundamentally what drives us. So our company really does exist to make a difference. We want to make a difference in the lives of the people that we work with in the company, in the lives of the partners that we work with, and especially in the lives of the people that are served by the utilities that we're supporting.
Well, that's amazing. And here you are allowing a country to increase its power transmission, and the effect of that is going to be more people in school for longer periods of time, more food grown, and probably better health care.
More industrial development. All
more
of
industrial
things.
Development. Wow, that's amazing. This is really a significant change, and this is not just in one small area with 50 countries that you're working with.
Oh, no. There are, at this point, something over 700 locations where a product has been installed, major locations. We've served on the order of about 300 utilities worldwide. This next year, we'll be operating in 50 different countries, so our people that are going out forming the relationships, helping to provide the technical support of the product once they've made a buying decision, and the like. We'll be traveling to that number of countries to basically take the message out and take the reality out.
So how long has the company been
The doing? Technology has been around for about 12 years. The company itself was formed in 2011, and so we've been growing it and developing it really since then. I joined in 2014, and we've basically quadrupled the business since then. We've been very blessed with some real believers in the technology, some people that had some fundamental needs and no other good solutions, and that's allowed us to really grow up and mature our team and our company.
That's a great example of how the effect of capitalism can really assist in many social efforts around the world.
Absolutely, and one of the interesting things is this is sort of a do well by doing good kind of thing, because effectively the utilities are realizing paybacks that are much less than 12 months.
Wow.
So on these projects, when they adopt the technology, they realize a financial benefit, you know, very, very early on.
Yeah, and so often, I mean, major, if they had to go out and buy the new right-of-ways and build new towers and then lay the lines, that would be an enormous capital investment.
Yeah, and those paybacks are something in excess of 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
So now, how would this affect, or how does this affect local utilities?
That's a great question. The product itself that's at the heart of this opportunity in the company, the product itself was envisioned by one of our founders standing on a Southern California Edison right-of-way with the engineer for Southern California Edison fussing about, we need new technology to stop our lines from sagging. Look at that. And he was pointing to a line that was overloaded and was sagging perilously close to a bunch of undergrowth.
Mm.
And so that's a very topical thing in California now.
That's potential fire.
Absolutely. And it's very topical, as you can imagine. And so we finally began serving and supporting Southern California Edison about 2.5 years ago, and they've now got a couple of dozen different projects that are on the books and in the process of being confirmed and installed currently. We're also working with, on the kind of the early stages, the engineers at PG&E. They've, of course, got some pretty major priorities right now, and they've got to address the biggest issues in front of them, but they will end up being significant users of the product because of the fundamental attributes that I've described.
So this would change the way that they were looking for the future to expand transmission.
Absolutely.
We would just change and take all of that. It's sort of like Caltrans thinking, we got to put in new freeways, and no, we're not going to put in new freeways. Somehow we're going to increase the capacity of the existing freeways.
Right, put decks on the freeways or something
like
that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Amazing. Yeah. All right. So how many national United States utilities have you?
So we've served, over time, we've served about 30 different utilities in the United States in varying degrees. A number of them are frequent users,
mm-hmm.
And we've got a seminal project, a real sort of high-profile project that was done in the Gulf Coast down in Texas, mm-hmm. Was completed about 3 years ago. That project enabled the reuse of about 245 miles of right-of-way to storm harden and increase the capacity to serve customers in Brownsville and other places down on sort of the deep south Texas coast.
That's where I grew up.
Very good.
Down in Edinburgh, Texas.
Well, your family members that are still in that area are being served by power lines owned by AEP and using our technology.
Excellent.
The interesting thing about that, AEP undertook that project with the support of the regulators in Texas, who were insisting on a much more storm-hardened grid. They did it for the capacity benefits that I described earlier. The additional benefit of the efficiency is the moral equivalent of them taking about 200,000 cars off the road.
Wow.
And they didn't even figure that into their economics.
Wow. Well, so you talk about hardening for storm hardening. How has that come about?
So that basically is, there's two elements to that. So one is the fundamental nature of the materials we use in the product are resistant to salt air. So they don't corrode, right? So it won't weaken over time as it's exposed to the salt environment along the Gulf Coast or in other areas. And the increased capacity gives the utility more optionality in terms of how to route power in case a line does go down. And so that's all taken together considered to be hardening.
It's sort of like the internet.
Absolutely.
Oh, wow. Very interesting. All right, so you mentioned that you... we're investing not only in your customers and your technology, but also in your people. Tell me about how that works in your company.
So we do that in very overt and sort of less obvious ways. One of the overt ways we do it is we provide a very generous tuition reimbursement. If a production worker comes up and says, I want to go get a mechanical engineering degree, all they have to do is lay out a plan and make good grades, and we'll reimburse them the cost for them to actually go accomplish that. We have, I think, five different people in various levels of the company operating in that way. We also, for each of the people in the company that wants to step forward, we'll work out a career development plan with them that sort of folds together operating and professional experiences that they want to achieve and specific education, whether it's in the form of industrial education or more formal degreed education. And we work with them on helping to ensure that those plans stay on track.
I want to share with you a whine that I've heard from people before, company leaders who were being asked to invest in the development of their people. What happens? How are you going to feel if after you've invested this money in these people and they get their degrees and they go off and work for somebody else?
Well, you've heard the famous rejoinder to that, right? Which is, what happens if we don't and they stay? So we'd much rather feel good about our mission, about investing in people, and if they have opportunities that are brighter than we can offer them, then they'll leave under good terms and good. We'll cheer them on.
Good. Very good. So now you... you weren't the founder of this. You didn't come up with the technology. And I understand that you have been involved in a number of different startups and entrepreneurial opportunities. So tell me a little bit about that.
So I got started in the entrepreneurial space back in the mid-1990s. I was running an unregulated arm of a natural gas pipeline company in Houston. And a group of investors that had invested in a company called Capstone Microturbines approached us about helping them to deploy their technology. And in the process of getting to know them, they decided, I think, that they liked me, and they recruited me into their startup, Capstone, to start building the commercial organization that would eventually enable that company to go very successfully public.
What, you about 13 in 1990?
No. It was early in my career, and I appreciate the question, but I was a little bit older than that.
Yeah. So and so you came in as what level?
And you're talking about in that organization?
Right.
Oh, I was the director of sales and marketing.
Ah, okay.
At that time.
All right. So tell me a little bit about what you have learned. What are the needs of, companies 10 to 250 employees? What are the real needs that they have right now?
I would say three things. One, you can never have too much talent. So if you're running a company like that, always be looking for talent, and sometimes figure out later how you're going to use them. You know, if they have a willing heart and a desire to grab a hold of something and sort of let it become what it'll become, then probably good talent to have on board. Two, you can never have too much cash. If you're doing a startup, 9 times out of 10, you're going to discover something about your plan that was wrong. So husband your cash, be smart about how you use it, and be prepared to drive through the lessons about what you're doing that's not right, that you can recover from. And the third thing is, be very crisp on your plan. If you have a complicated plan, people will not understand it, and they will not be able to internalize how to execute it. If you have a clear plan, and people can see themselves in the middle of that plan, you've got a much higher chance for success.
All right. When you think about talent, I have seen lots of people who who have great talents, great skills, great abilities, but they're really not very likable. They really don't fit the culture of the company. Have you experienced that?
Absolutely. One of the things we've done at CTC Global, my fellow senior managers and I got together and effectively went through a process to determine and be able to describe what kind of people we wanted to be and what kind of people we wanted to work with. Mm-hmm. And there was a book written by Patrick Lencioni called The Ideal Team Player. Mm-hmm. And in it, it basically describes people that are humble. In other words, it's about the team, not about me. Mm-hmm. And they've got the ability to put others first and let their own interests come second or third. Hungry, I'll chew through a brick wall to get done what I committed to getting done. Mm-hmm. Right? And smart, meaning people smart. They can walk into a room and very quickly assess the mood, the environment of the room, understand how they're coming across, and adapt that on a very purposeful basis. And so we've built our team around those attributes of hungry, humble, and smart. In fact, when we're hiring, and we've done a lot of hiring, we've been very blessed to have opportunities to bring a lot of people into the company. By the time someone comes in our front door for an interview, we know they can do the job. Mm-hmm. If they can't do the job and we don't know that they can do the job, they're not invited in. Mm-hmm. If they're coming in our front door, they're coming to be assessed about whether they're a good fit for the team, and it's against those attributes that we're looking.
And so it's these core values that you're really using to mm-hmm. to assess them. How often do people forget that they're going to be living with these people and that these people will be seen as the face of the company
right.
in the marketplace?
Yeah, it has been a pretty common problem for us. It's less so because we're now 2.5 years into this hungry, humble, smart hiring profile. And we're seeing some pretty significant benefits. I would say one more thing on your question earlier, Will. The one thing that we cannot stand, that we cannot deal with, is arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to have a good, full, honest view of one's abilities and how one can contribute and impact the mm-hmm. opportunity or problem at hand. But you've got to always leave space for others.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so humble, hungry, smart, no arrogance.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I wonder how many companies out there really spend time on defining their core values.
Good question. I certainly couldn't posit.
You've been in significant company. Yeah, significant number of companies mm-hmm. that have been entrepreneurial and working on that.
I'd say it's about 50%.
Yeah.
That when you meet them, they can say, "Here's what we're about. Here are our values. Here are the kind of people we want to work with." It's about half.
So, I mean, now there, I'm going to ask you about the process that you came up with this. You mentioned Lencioni. I mean, there's a couple of ways people can come up with core values. One is the founder says, these are the core values.
Mm-hmm.
You can use industry or great people like Patrick Lencioni and say, these are core values, because he said they ought to be. And there's another way, which is to begin talking to the leadership team, because they're the ones that are really living those core values. And until they agree that these are, in fact, our core values, that could be a significant kind of inauthentic presence. So how did you guys come up with these?
We basically pulled ourselves through a knothole backwards in an offsite process
uh-huh.
and really got vulnerable with one another about what we liked or didn't like about working with each other.
Mm.
And that we always started with, I need to change this about me,
mm-hmm.
right? We wouldn't listen to, you need to change this about you, mm-hmm. until they had said, I need to change this about me.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that over a period of a couple of days with a dinner or two thrown in for people to go off and reflect on it, and you can affect some pretty significant. We weren't changing people's personalities, but we mm-hmm. were changing each other's perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we got that all done, we came up with a series of statements that we reduced to writing, mm-hmm. and then we put those on effectively a certificate. We all signed them, and we described that whole process to the company at large.
And that signing becomes your agreement.
It's framed on everybody's wall.
It's not an expectation.
No, it's what we're going to do.
This is it.
Yeah.
And have you had to have the unfortunate, uncomfortable conversation with people who
practically daily?
Oh,
practically daily. So one of the things that we also agreed to is we were going to prefer to help people to be better rather than to feel better. And that means, as adults, that we've got to take on uncomfortable issues and do it with the right perspective and the right attitude, with a desire to actually improve the situation. And that comes up on a, I would say it's less frequent now, but early on it was, you know, two or three times a day somebody was apologizing to somebody else for crossing a line. But even that part of the process was very cathartic.
Well, now, with your 400 employees, how deep does that value, core value conversation go?
I would say fully 200 of them have been hired in under kind of a measure of those attributes. Then more recently, we took a set of value statements. So we have attributes, which is what I've described. And then we took a set of value statements, which I sort of dictated. I was came into a situation, was a little bit in disarray, and I said, guys, we've got to have values. Here they are. So then over the last 3 months or so, we've basically thrown those up in the air and worked through a process with the management team where now we have six value statements.
What are they?
They have to do with, I don't have them all sort of on top of the mind, but they have to do with respect and innovation, safety, quality, and the like, and they're very short statements. And those have been taken to every employee in the company. So we've rolled those out, and I've described what it looks like and what it doesn't look like and what do we do when we mess up and those sorts of things. And I've gotten some amazingly positive feedback.
From so how often do you reinforce that with people?
Every day.
Well, not with all 400.
Every day. We're expecting that the supervisors will reinforce some element of those values in just about every conversation with employees every day. Why are we picking up that area? Because it shows respect for the next shift. That kind of thing.
Well, that's good. Do you ever evaluate your people about how well they are? You know, they do it most of the time. They don't do it most of the time. Sometimes they do, sometimes. Do you ever have that kind of evaluation?
Routinely. So we have a kind of an ethos, if you will, where every conversation is about performance. It's not a judgment on performance, but it's a it's about how do we meet our objectives, how do we meet our commitments, and how do we improve. And from that perspective, you can tell very quickly who's open to it, who gets it, and who doesn't. And generally what I would say is the people that are open to it, that are really looking to improve every day, they're the ones that are really excelling at the company, and the ones that aren't are eventually they end up deciding that they'll be more comfortable somewhere else. And we're okay with that.
Well, that's right. And that's, you know, I often hear people say, oh, we have to, you know, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus. So I don't want to fire them. I don't want to. It's, you know, this is negative thing about how we deal with people who don't fit, who either don't have our core values or don't get it, want it, or have the capacity for doing the job. And it seems to me that, that what you said is a much better way of looking at it. If we're not happy, they're not happy.
Absolutely.
And nobody deserves to stay in a place where they're not happy.
Right.
So helping them. And it's happened to me when I was asked to leave. You know, there's this initial shock, and sometimes it might take a year of therapy to deal with. But but eventually, the recognition is that didn't fit. It just didn't fit. But what I'm doing now fits a lot better.
Right.
Because I looked at that difficulty and found a place where I didn't have to deal with that that limiting factor.
Right.
And it seems to me that approach to a relationship in a job for a supervisor is much more helpful both to the company, to themselves, and to the employee.
Right. The biggest step forward that we've made has actually not been at the senior leadership level. It's been at the supervisor level, where they've come to the realization that when they're working with somebody trying to correct a behavior or improve a performance, they're seeing that now not as an authoritarian move, but as an investment. They are investing in that person, and if they're open to it, then it's going to be a productive investment, and if they aren't, then there's a different path.
Right, right. Well, I say it's a much more significant conversation.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely.
And from I've had people sitting in that chair who are in this conversation talking about millennials.
Mm-hmm.
And the attitude, the management attitude that you have is what takes away a lot of the difficulties that we ascribe to millennials.
Because mm-hmm.
they want to be recognized. They want to have a path forward. And if they're up against a wall, that's when I see these strange behaviors come out about, I want this, and I want this, and I want it now, because nobody's given them a path. Nobody's really listened to them.
Right. That's a big part of it, is helping people to paint a picture for themselves, for what they want their future to be, and then having them see us as a partner on helping them towards that future, whether it's the nature of the benefits programs that we make available, the very attractive 401k program to encourage them to start saving for that future, the educational programs. We can't do it for them, but we can be willing to help them and to put the tools in place so that if they decide they want to, they can do.
Well, now talking about painting a picture, if we looked out ahead 3 years from now, and we were getting back together 3 years from now, and we were seeing that every part of that picture had been achieved. Can you see that picture in your head 3 years from now for the company?
Absolutely.
And you see yourself in that picture?
Absolutely.
What needs to change in the next 3 years for that picture to be there?
So there are probably three things that we're actively working on to bring that future in our minds to reality. And one is removing the things from the company that are impeding our ability to scale. So taking the things that are good about the company and scaling them and doing it in a way that that ensures that we can accomplish the, by that point, we should be another four times larger than we are now.
Hmm.
And so that's business systems, and it's processes, it's job definition, it's all of these things, and we're actively addressing that now. The second thing is, when we show up at a utility company, particularly a utility company in a developing country, and knock on their door, right now we're selling project by project. They have this need from point A to point B. They have this other need from point C to point D, and this other need from point E to point F. That's it's a great business, and it has been a real difference maker for those utilities and for our company and the people that the utilities are serving. Doing this at a much larger scale is going to require that we show up and make a network sell. So we're showing up at the utility company now not to talk about project from point A to point B, but a whole series of projects. And when we're doing that, we need to show up with the financing to enable that project to happen. And so we're very actively working with a large number of the kind of the non-government banks that actively invest in infrastructure and increasingly in green infrastructure, so that we can put those packages together and show up with a system-wide solution and not just a solution from point A to point B. And then the third thing that we're actively working is on the talent front. So we need increasingly high-end talent to take that kind of a package and go sell it and deliver it. So it's sort of a consultative activity. You basically need to sit in a room with utility engineers, then you need to sit in the room with utility decision makers, then you need to sit in the room with government officials who have sway over the purse strings, and convince all of them that this makes a lot of sense for their people, their country, and their various mandates that they're working to fulfill.
So really to move from bits and bytes.
Absolutely.
To talking about ROIs.
Absolutely.
And social benefits as well as political
yes.
advances.
Right.
That's a pretty significant step up mm-hmm. in terms of salesmanship.
It is.
It's a whole different mentality, and it's very difficult to take a bits and bytes person and move them into that.
We've been surprised. That was sort of the going-in presumption. We've been surprised that as we've made additional tools and relationships available, our people have actually done a very good job of seeing the opportunity and getting their arms around it. But part of it is simply because the company was basically an overgrown startup, and people are attracted to that usually have many skill sets and have what I call a belly full of fire. I mean, they really want to change the world, and they see this as their avenue to do it.
Right. If their hair is not on fire, then obviously we're not doing enough.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So what might be barriers, obstacles, dangers to getting any of these, removing the impediments to scale, becoming project-minded, and finding the talents to sell those projects?
I think with respect to the internal hurdles, it's just staying focused on doing the non-glamorous work of defining work instructions and implementing systems around those work instructions. There's nothing sexy about it. There's no external glory associated with it.
No hair on fire.
No, well, but that's the issue, right? Can you do it with a hair on fire, right? Can you do it as though the next deliverable matters? Life depends on it, kind of a thing. And so that's a key hurdle that we're working to address. On the second point, we need additional partners to work with. So earlier in the interview, I described that we end up working with all of the companies that do substation work. So when we increase capacity on a line, inevitably there's some work that's got to be done in the substation when that voltage is being stepped down to a usable level. And we've got to be able to team up with these kinds of companies to go in and do this network sell. They've got to be a part of the proposal. They don't have to be a part of the planning process, but they've got to be a part of the proposal. And so forming those relationships, convincing them why it makes sense early in the process and why it's worth their time and effort before they get a sale is key. And then on the talent front, the issue there is moving from being able to describe to you in the context of this interview the talent that we need and to go out and identify it and actually recruit it and get it on board. And that is not an overnight process. And so we reckon that it'll probably take about 6 months to add the kind of talent we can make use of going into this next year, and we're actively working that now.
And one of the things that I have seen make a significant change in leadership conversations is something I learned from my coach, Dan Sullivan, is the who, not how. So often I've seen leadership teams come to an issue, obviously something has to change, and it's really not in the area of expertise of any of the people in the leadership team. But they feel like they are compelled to come up with how to solve this problem. And helping them to move from how to who, if they can simply define what it is that this problem really is and what results they want, what solution are we looking for? Not how do we get there, but what are we going to be happy with when we get?
Right.
And then to stop and go find the who can demonstrate that they've done this before, they know how to do it, they're accountable for it, they certainly fit into the culture of the company, but that who becomes the one that produces the how.
So the attribute that we described earlier called humble comes into play here significantly. We point to it often. The fact that we need more talent does not take anything away from the talent that we have on board. Right? It's additive or even multiplicative. And so what we want to do is have our leaders thinking about the overall impact we're trying to have. Frankly, they're all very busy, and it's not about turf or fiefdom, right? It's all about being in a place where we can focus on the things that we, as individuals, uniquely need to do and letting others do the rest of it. And so, for the most part, I think we've gotten beyond that particular challenge. But we'll see. I'll prove it to you when we have that conversation in about 3 years.
Good. And that it's that, you know, it's that unique ability that people can focus on. Because if they only live in their unique ability, they're going to be not only tremendously productive, they're going to be exquisitely happy.
Absolutely.
And so often, coming out of what I've seen, people coming out of a startup when they literally had to do everything, and their first move is to hire assistants that they tell people what to do. And when they get beyond that and start finding people who already know how to, they're really finding who's rather than just assistants. then things begin to change, because now I don't even have to pay attention to that. I can look at it once a week on the scorecard, and I know that it's there. And yet, there's always these additional places of need as businesses grow, and people continually fall into that trap of, well, we can figure out how to, we can speculate, maybe this will work, versus this is what we want, this is the problem, let's go find the who.
I very much agree with the perspective.
So tell me, what opportunities are there that you have that will help you with this?
Within you're talking about within
three,
the company?
These three things that we're going to see 3 years from now.
So the efforts to address the internal constraints is actually well underway. In fact, many of the initiatives will be fully implemented by December. And so what we're seeing is work processes get streamlined dramatically. The number of people involved in the work processes is going down. One of the things that companies like ours struggle with is making use of their data. And so, gee, I have a need. Well, I don't have a system solution, so I'm going to go develop a spreadsheet. As soon as I develop a spreadsheet, data gets islanded. And so we're in the process now of retiring a lot of work functions that have been done around individual spreadsheets, so that they're all of that data is on the system and can be entered once. And that should be fully implemented by December.
Are you using a particular software for that? Is it generated internally?
It's within the accounting and the Microsoft system, Microsoft level system software that we're using.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, we've got a firm that's working with us to take the work instructions that our working team is coming up with, and then developing code around those working instructions.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah, and that's been. You know, probably by the end of it, we will have spent $500,000 getting that implemented, and it'll be pay for itself probably in about 6 months' time or less.
Yeah, sure. Talent. What are the opportunities for finding this talent?
Oh, the effort's underway. And so what we've found is oftentimes if we can describe the talent we need, then we can look within our own networks. As you know, the most successful hires are usually people that are referred to us by folks that we already know and respect.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're working those networks currently for this talent now. It's unique because some of the opportunities that we need to pursue are in places that others view as particularly challenging to work in. So we have huge upside in Africa and in Southeast Asia and South Asia, which are big markets for us today, and lots of upside. And so finding the talent that knows how to originate business in the U.S. is actually fairly straightforward. Finding mm-hmm. talent that knows how to live in the U.S., work as a part of a U.S. management team, and originate business in Africa, that's an interesting nut to crack.
So to what extent are you using Africans to do that?
We will as we establish the offices. So what we need right now is people that can get to know and really know us and fly in and identify the agents within these countries. Then we use the agents to actually beat the drum with utilities on mm-hmm. a regular basis. And then we fly in and out and support those agents on a very intensive basis.
So you're really becoming a multicultural organization as well as a global organization.
Very much so.
I mean, I've seen global organizations that are all white. Right?
Yes.
And used to be all male. Fortunately, that's being addressed, and that there's more women, which is good. But very often, companies coming out of the U.S., they're either all white or whatever color they are, they act white.
I appreciate that. We've taken a different approach. And so the people that are running our joint venture facility in Indonesia are Indonesians. The people that are running our business development office in Malaysia and all of our support engineers, they're Malaysians. Or in a couple of cases, we actually brought people in from Korea to work with them. So the people in our Pune office, they're Indians.
Mm-hmm. Now, to what extent, what's the conversation around the core values and the attributes you were talking about?
Ongoing and regular at all levels, including those.
Is there any resistance to that?
We haven't seen any.
Uh-huh.
I would say it's relatively early days. The attributes are well established, the hungry, humble, smart.
Mm-hmm.
But the values that I described to you a few minutes ago, those just started getting rolled out this last month.
Mm-hmm.
And so We're looking for opportunities to test them. We've basically stated for values that matter, you're tested just about every day on them. So look for the opportunities and score a win.
Well, I wonder if you ever would find it helpful to have an all-hands meeting. It probably involve a lot of video conferencing, but an all-hands meeting where you address those core values and give some examples of people who've done a great job with it, and sometimes when it doesn't work.
It's a great idea. We've done versions of that, but we haven't done it since we rolled the values out. So mm-hmm. I think I'll take this as a opportunity poke and make that happen.
Well, that's what we tell people in the entrepreneurial operating system who are doing that. Every quarter, reinforce that, because it takes 7 or 8 times for people to hear it the mm-hmm. first time.
Sure.
And it comes from the leaders of the company. And so having that opportunity as well, and taking that time to talk about, these are the things that we said we would do in the last 90 days, and this is what we actually did. This is where we're going in the next 90 days. And that, to me, getting that 90-day life moving forward so that we're actually getting some success every 90 days. So strengths in the company, too, that you have already that they're going to make this picture come to be.
The company and the people in it and the processes care very much about driving great outcomes. And there isn't a utility that we work with yet that would complain about a lack of technical support or a lack of time or attention to drive good outcomes for them. It is sort of in the lifeblood of the company in very many ways. We have utilities from all over the world visit our facility because they come for factory acceptance tests, and they walk away blown away by the cleanliness of the facility, the professional posture of the people, the substantial nature of the manufacturing process, and all of the quality checks and the like. That is a real solid strength. Mm-hmm. Transparency and ownership of mistakes has become, over the last year or so, a very significant strength. I've found that if people can admit a mistake and view it as an opportunity to improve, then everything's better. It's much easier to work together and to not be embarrassed by or try to hide, you know, the fact that I or they are imperfect.
Well, one of the things that I share with my clients in EOS is that there is no such thing as failure. You're either achieving what you said you would do, or you're learning.
Right.
I mean, the only people that don't learn are losers, because there is no failure. It's we'll either achieve or we'll learn how to do it.
Right.
And so that's what I hear here when you talk about taking responsibility for things. Anything else, strengths?
I think the company is very, in the context of its industry, is a very significant technical innovator.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not just resting on our laurels and trying to drive this product into kind of a scale position in the business. We're innovating around it, so other forms of conductor, other types of material, other capabilities within the existing product. And I think we're on the verge of seeing some really neat things come from that innovation.
Good. Well, I mean, from what you tell me, you are a poster child for a company that's gone through the entrepreneurial operating system, because the kind of things you're talking about are the things that we get to. We get to the place where everybody in the entire company knows exactly where it's going, how it's going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
People are all, every one of them becomes much more disciplined and accountable, and everything they do is executing toward that vision, and they are part of a open, transparent, responsible team that's working together. And because unfortunately, in many companies, leaders don't work well on teams. And
yes.
It sounds to me like you've pretty much taken care of that.
I think each of the leaders in our company has had to do some soul searching about why they're at the company, about what they intend to achieve being there, what they're willing to receive from their colleagues,
mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, why they get out of bed in the morning.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. That's That's what it means to want to do the job.
Absolutely.
Bounce out of bed in the morning. I assume you do.
Absolutely. I come in excited every day.
That's right. It's wonderful. Well, what would you like to tell businesses in Orange County who want to grow? What might be some things that you could give them?
I would simply say there's a difference between wanting to grow and investing to grow. And usually when you're investing to grow, you feel a little naked. Whether it's you're worried about your people or your systems or your capital or whatever. And my advice is power through it. If you wait for the conditions to be perfect, you'll never do it.
Wonderful. Well, thanks a lot, J.D., for being with us today. These are great nuggets of wisdom for any company to take in. Congratulations on doing not only such a good job technically and financially, but also providing such a tremendous advantage to companies around, to countries around the world in terms of all those social pluses that they get from increasing the electrical transmission.
Thank you, Will. I'm very proud of my team and my company. It's really much more about them and the people we serve than it is about me. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you.
Good. And I hope you'll share this interview with them.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, there you are. A wonderful company in Orange County that's not only thriving in Orange County, but is also making a tremendous impact around the globe in terms of improving educational opportunities, financial opportunities, healthcare opportunities all around the world because of what they can do to increase the transmission on existing electrical towers and rights of way. So thanks a lot for being with us, JD, and that's just another way of businesses in Orange County can thrive.
You've been listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist.